This is the Greek God of Hops podcast with two-time World Series champion Kevin Youkilis and sponsored by Loma Brewing Company at lomabrew.com.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Youkilis from Loma Brewing Company, and this is the Greek God of Hops podcast. Today, I'm joined with comedian, actor Steve Byrne. Funny, funny dude from Pittsburgh, PA. Now living out in Pasadena, California. Just an all-around good guy, funny guy, and some amazing stories. So hope you enjoy this podcast. What's up, Steve? How you doing, buddy?
Good. Unsubscribe, please. I think you have the wrong number. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. With all this corona stuff, it's going.
I've heard of it, yeah. It seems to be taking a toll, and I don't think, from what I'm gathering, I don't think people like their 30-day free trial of socialism, I guess. I don't know. It's a crazy, crazy time right now.
I know. What are you guys, doing to keep the kids? You're a father of two kids, correct?
You got two kids. I got a daughter who's 7 and a son who's 4. So one is being, I guess homeschooled, and the other is just playing with Star Wars figures every day, which kind of makes me proud, but because you got to entertain the one and educate the other, it does become a seesaw between the parents. And unfortunately for my wife, I'm a night owl, so she's got to take over double duty until 9 or 10 in the morning, and then I'll come in and save the day, hopefully.
Nice, yeah.
But that's been it for me. How about you?
I got a 5, a 7, and a 13, soon to be 14-year-old. My two boys are 5 and 7, and wow. They're good, and then, of course, they're brothers, and they just go ready to kill each other. So it's kind of fun.
Oh, you're sick.
Yeah. Luckily, my daughter, she's a savior. She's amazing. She does so much work for us with those boys. So she loves them and takes good care of them. So we're pretty sick.
But your daughter's definitely the oldest, and I've always heard that, because when I had my daughter first, then I had my son, people are like, oh, it's really good that you have an older, that he's going to have an older sister, because when it's the older sister, they keep things in line a little more. And I found that to be kind of the case with us. Is that the case with you guys then? Obviously, it sounds like it, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. She's a second mom, and but they also treat her a lot different than they do mom. So it's
of course, yeah.
It's so hard. I watch sometimes. I'm like, oh my god, these boys are ruthless. But then it takes you back to your childhood, right? And then you kind of realize kids are mean. They can be.
Kids are the cruelest. I think. Oh my god, Steve Simone has such a great bit about like little kids. He's like, if you ever want to feel awful about yourself, have a 6-year-old draw a picture of you, because they'll accentuate the worst parts of your face. And that always made me laugh. But yeah, kids are cool. They're not nice, but they'll find the one thing that's like your Achilles heel,
right,
and just drive on it. And that's always been the case. But I think, again, like when you're a kid, the things you get made fun of becomes kind of your superpower when you get older. No matter what it is. So I've always found that to be the case. But yeah, it's definitely been nice to be off the road, to not be a stand-up comedian for a few weeks, and to spend so much time at home. But then it kind of becomes like that movie, The Hurt Locker, where Jeremy Renner's just at war, and the whole time he's at war, he's calling his wife and looking at pictures of his son, and then he comes home decommissioned, and he spends time with his family. 2 weeks later, he's like, man, fuck this. I got to go back to war. He goes back to Afghanistan or Iraq. That's kind of the feeling. I want to ask you that. Is that true with, like, so many of the professional athletes, they retire and they always say, I got to spend more time with my family. And then, like, 3 weeks into retirement, they're back on the podium again going, you know what? I missed the game. I got to come back. Is that what it is?
It is in some ways. I think for me personally, it was my body was killing me. I put it through hell and back. So for me, it was a little different. But yeah, I mean, you sit at home and you're just like, as a professional athlete, your days are, everything is regimented out. I mean, every single day you have a set schedule. You're here, you're there, you're doing this, you're doing that. You got to go here. And so you have your whole entire life planned out for you. every single day. Right. And then the off season, you gotta be more independent and figure it out on your own. And if you don't, you're just gonna come into spring training looking, sloppy, and you're not gonna have a good season. So that was for me. I think that was the hardest part, was getting adjusted to life after. And it takes a year. I mean, there's a little depression, a little anxiety that hits you. You know, you don't know what the next, I was 35 years old and, made more money than I ever thought I would. And, got to live the luxurious life of playing baseball. And the next thing you know, it's like, oh God, what do I do? And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to open a brewery. And then I was like, oh wow. I didn't know there was like all this stuff that goes in owning a restaurant and a brewery. But it fulfills your time.
Yeah, just curious, too. You ended up West doing that, correct? And nothing with your time in Boston, you would think that would be like a slam dunk over on the East Coast. But you did it on the West Coast. How did you end up out West Side? Was it the wife? Was it the family life?
Yeah, my wife grew up in San Mateo, California, which is about 20 minutes south of San Francisco. And when I was playing, I think it was 2012. I went to spring training, and in that off season, I was looking for a bunch of houses out here because this is where she wanted to live. And I joke around, I went from owning a house in Massachusetts where I paid a lot of taxes to California where I was like, you know what? I just want to pay more taxes. I mean, that's my goal, is to pay as many taxes as possible before I die. And then I'll pay more taxes when I die. So I followed her out here, and she literally found a home and sent it to me online, like while I'm at spring training. And she's like, this is the house. And I'm like, all right, cool. Send me pictures. And,
wow.
Yeah. So it was kind of wild in that sense. Right. But I looked while she was working, she was teaching. So I looked at a bunch of real estate and I was like, holy cow. And you know how it is in California. You see, you look at numbers and you're like, what? I was like, why don't we live back in the Midwest? I was like, can we go home? I can get you five of these houses for the same price. I was like, this is ridiculous. We can get a compound. We can invite everyone back to Cincinnati.
Of course. Yeah. California's crazy.
Yeah. So you grew up in Pittsburgh, right?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, and actually you're an Ohio boy. Is that correct?
That's correct. Everything from where you grew up came down to us on that river.
Yeah. So I actually went to Kent State University in Ohio. And I've been to every major city, obviously, in Ohio, and ended up with a hangover because of my days in Kent State. So I've been to Columbus, Tennessee, everywhere all over Ohio, all the big schools and stuff. And just, I'm so glad I went to school in Ohio because, and Pittsburgh too. Pittsburgh's such a blue collar. I think Pittsburgh's kind of reminiscent of Boston because it's kind of got that grit to it. There's a blue collar kind of mentality to it. And I think obviously you were adored in Boston because you're like the epitome of like a blue collar kind of guy. I mean, not only from your play, but also your aesthetics. And I think if you were a Steeler, Pirate, or Penguin, you'd be still on billboards, probably at hawking a Toyota dealership doing advertisements for them and stuff. Because yeah. Pittsburgh certainly celebrates its blue-collar kind of roots.
Sure.
But, yeah, I'm so glad to have grown up in the Midwest because I think you have those Midwestern values, and I think there is something to be celebrated about a blue-collar kind of mentality too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's something that shapes you. I think that's why the Midwest I mean, we both have a love for it probably because that's our roots, but there's something to be said about the people, the environment, the community, the sports, like you said. I mean, I got to say, do not like the Steelers too much. And Sean Casey grew up there and, he calls it Legitsburg. I don't know if you refer to it as Legitsburg, but we share some great stories. And some of the best people I've ever met are from the Midwest. I mean, they moved and gone on to other places.
Sean Casey is like an unofficial mayor of Pittsburgh. That dude is on BBE, the big radio show there all the time. And I've called in a few times. And I've never been in studio with the guy, but every time I come back to Pittsburgh, my one buddy who's a fellow comedian is like, man, you got to spend one night out with Casey. It'll be the funnest night of your life. And I've just always heard the best things about that guy.
Oh, yeah. Dude, Casey's the best. I mean, he is the mayor of Cincinnati for being on the Reds. But, yeah, he's definitely the mayor of Legitsburg. And, we went out there when I worked for the Cubs. And when the Cubs played the Pirates in that one game playoff, we went out that night, yeah. And it was Chris Chelios, Eddie Vedder, Sean Casey, myself, and we go to like some Italian restaurant, like after we were celebrating and partying it up, and we go to Casey's like buddies. We're in the basement of his Italian restaurant. And we were drinking all night, and it was like till 4 or 5 in the morning. And Case was just, oh, he was on fire. I mean, you know, he is one of those dudes you want to go out with and hang with. And believe it or not, he's been sober for like over a year now. So he's still, oh, wow. He's still fun to hang out with. I went out with him in Arizona, and he's sober, and I'm proud of him. And he's still the same dude. You know, he'll get up and do all of his little, I mean, he's almost a comedian in some ways. I mean, I think you guys would really, really hit it off.
Yeah, damn it! I miss my opportunity to be like hanging out with Jordan on the Wizards now. It's like yeah. I'm still hanging out with him, but it's not the same. So maybe yeah. One day.
Yeah, no. Let's hope not. But maybe.
Well, I got to ask you, what is it? Because I'm like a casual baseball fan, and I was a New York comic for many years, and just due to the rivalry, what was it like? And I'm sure you probably get asked 1,000 times these questions, but what was it like to be at that time playing on the Sox against the Yankees when that rivalry was actually so enormous? It was, it definitely permeated the whole city at the time in New York, and you read the New York every day and keeping up with it and watching the games because every bar has those games on, and to just see how much tension there was because the last time for me as a sports fan, I saw a rivalry that heated. It was probably Colorado Detroit back in the 90s when Red Wings would play the Avalanche, and you could tell they did not like each other. Was it intense, or was it just more kind of played up in the New York media?
No, I always joke around. The Boston media is way worse, but the New York media was the second. And no, it was pretty tense. I mean, I the 2003 series probably amplified it, of course, with, you know, Don Zimmer and Pedro. And that amplified a lot of the tension and just, you know, Pedro and his mentality and just the Yankees' mentality, too. I mean, there's so many great, you know, guys on that team, too, that were just, I mean, it was a superstar lineup. And, you know, we had a bunch of superstar and veterans. And for me, that was my rookie year in 2004. So I was new on the scene. I was just trying to stay there as best I could. But man, it was awesome. I mean, it's not fun. Like we always joke around Tampa Bay, like going to play in Tampa Bay stinks because there's not a lot of fans and it's boring. I love the tension. I love the fans yelling at me, telling me I stink. It's like, you know, it's like a comedian that gets up there and, you know, you're getting all heckled and saying stuff. And, you know, I bet you the same thing with comedians. It's like the ones that are the best can get up there and, you know, they can give it back. And that's how I was. I mean, I loved it. I called it AHA, athletes hater adrenaline. So that was always my thing. I was like, AHA, and being a Jewish guy, you know, from coming to America at all fit. but I thrived on it.
I mean, but there are certain players like yourself that would thrive on it, and there's definitely other players I'm sure you've seen throughout your career that capitulate to it. Is that correct, too? Where people,
totally.
Where when the heat comes on, they just crumble.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just some guys. Well, for me, I had to work for everything. I got nothing handed to me, and I was one of those guys that had to come up and scrap and show my worth. And you know, some of it was a good thing to have the chip on the shoulder, but it also hurt me at times. You know, trying to have that chip on the shoulder, trying to prove my worth all the time, and people are like, "Dude, just chill. It's okay. You know, we get it." You know,
yeah.
And I'm like, "No, you don't get it. I gotta." You know, next thing you know, you're like, "Oh yeah, I do need to calm down a little bit here." But that was my mentality is this, you know, people always told me, oh, you couldn't do this. You can't, you know, I played 4 years of college baseball and didn't get drafted until my senior year. I saw Michael Vick get drafted in the 30th round my junior year and didn't play baseball
wow.
since junior high. So, like, I was like, what is this? I'm like, man, I'm playing against these guys getting drafted and I feel like I'm good enough. So just scrap my way through it. So for me, I held myself more accountable and I was harder on myself. So it didn't bother me that other people were being hard. Yeah, a little sensitive in some ways. I didn't like people, you know, talking smack. I don't think anyone does. But you can either you know, let it get to you, or you can use it to your advantage. And I just, it just pumped me up. It made me feel like I was seven foot tall.
Yeah, there's definitely, like, especially in the comedy world, there's certain comedians that got anointed out of the gates and have always worked. And there's comics that just come fresh on the scene and they pop and they're huge and they get thrown all this work. And then there's other guys, I think, kind of like myself, where nothing's ever been handed to you. And you're always kind of looking over your shoulder as a comic. The healthiest way to be a comedian is to play golf. Is that way you're competing against yourself. You're not competing against anybody else, because comedy's so subjective, and there isn't data. There's not stats every year,
right?
You know. So for me, it's I think that, you know, prior to the phone call, I went on Wikipedia and read up on your career, just so I was, you know, I hate like when you, you know, especially like when I've done radio interviews in the past and they don't even know how to pronounce my name. So I think it's always respectful to, you know, just do as much research as you can before you do a platform like this. And in reading about your career, it made me respect you even more, because at face value, you're just watching somebody on ESPN or watching the game and you think, this guy's, you know, a multimillionaire and he's playing for the Sox and an all-star and I'm sure he's got it made. And then the more I read about your career, just like, my God, you had to fight and claw for every single accolade or contract signing, or being, you know, shuttled up to the majors and back down to the minors. Even when you're, you know, you hit a home run your first game, you think, okay, I think this is a good sign, right? And then you
right.
get tossed right back down. It's like, this doesn't seem like, for some people, it's just never easy.
No, and that is probably in the comedy world. It's like you get, you know, it could be somebody that could put out a special and they hit big, but now you got to put out more specials, right? I mean, you can't just live off that one. You got to keep going and going and giving the audience more and more. I mean, it's...
Oh, well, these days, Kev, it's so crazy these days. I mean, when I started, you could tour literally off of a half-hour special on Comedy Central. You could tour off of that for maybe 2 or 3 years. And these days, because of the landscape of content, you constantly have to churn stuff out. And not only churn out an hour special, but there's so many comics that have podcasts now that you gotta keep up with that. And
right.
So it's really, really a different ball of wax. And so I think what's it's like, how do you want to put the content out? And so there's comics that do podcasts, which is daily. You could do hour specials if you're contract with Netflix and you got to put one out every year to year and a half, which I think is a bad thing, because a lot of the comics that turn out so many of those specials, it's quantity over quality. And that's the gripe you hear from a lot of comedy fans, is I wish so and so would have taken another year or two to develop it. And I agree, I think it takes a long time to develop those specials. And then I've had 4 hour specials. I've had, you know, a television show that lasted 3 seasons, and the minute the show went off the air in 2014, I had an hour come out like a year or two after that, and it just dried up so quickly. The industry forgets you. They move on to the next bright, shiny object, because Netflix has turned out so many of these hour specials that it's tough to stay relevant. So, you know, I basically, like yourself, I was never given anything. I was never, you know, anointed. All my hour specials have been acquisitions. They've never been produced. In other words, when I say that, it's like Comedy Central or Netflix never saw me and said, oh my God, we're going to get behind this guy and put him up on billboards and make him part of our yearly platform. It was just, I filmed it on my own, and then they said, okay, we'll buy it, and then they put it on the air, and they never advertised it or never got behind it, you know? So
interesting.
I've always been kind of like this redheaded stepchild, even though I'm Korean and Irish, in stand-up comedy. So basically, I took the time off, and I thought, okay, well, how am I going to supersede or jump the line? What can I do? So I basically, you know, read all these books on screenwriting, and I wrote a film about my early years in stand-up called The Opening Act, and that'll be coming out. It was supposed to come out in July, but because of this coronavirus craziness, it'll come out in October. And I think I may have been the one person involved in the stand-up comedy world that actually wrote and directed a feature film about stand-up comedy that got the world right. So I'm super excited for that to come out, and hopefully that can, you know, prove yourself. Ultimately, I think you're always trying to prove it to yourself, kind of, you know, put yourself in that circle and say, see, I belong here. I fought and clawed for everything. And I think you might agree with this more than most, is that when you end up at the after party, the whiskey tastes a little sweeter when you got a little dirt underneath your fingernails.
Oh, it does, right? I mean, I think that's the interesting part of it all is, you know, as that was going to ask you, does that, is that drive of not getting things handed to you, is that what keeps you scratching and clawing and coming up with good material?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure. I mean, even when you're, you know, you're at the comedy store nightly, like, you know, where I think we initially got to meet is that you're performing with, like, there have been nights where I'm at the comedy store and I look at those lineups and I'm like, holy shit. Like, I, you know, even as a comedy, as a comic, I look at these lineups and I'm like, that's a festival lineup. Like, that's a $200, you know, ticket. You see Rogan, Jeselnik, Whitney, Bert Kreischer, Tom Segura, D'Elia, you know, Nick Kroll, John Mulaney, Eliza, and then Mark Maron. And then in the middle of that is yourself. And so I think that initially, just on a weekly basis, I'm like, I got to prove myself that I belong here with all these other people. And in talking to a lot of the other comics, they say the same thing. So, you know, it's kind of nice to know that we all still have that insecurity of, like, proving ourselves to be there. But I've never been somebody that's been anointed by the industry or, you know, never, you know, even when I had my, I had done the Tonight Show 10 times. And then the minute I got my sitcom, nobody would have me on a late night talk show. And we're on 3 seasons, 2.5 million viewers an episode. And there was never anybody that ever was like, yeah, I'll have him on the show. And it was just the oddest thing of, like, as a comic, you come to L.A. hoping to get your own show. And then the minute you get the show, you're thinking, okay, now things are going to change. Now I'm going to be, you know, invited to talk shows or do interviews or, you know, end up on Entertainment Tonight or Extra. And the minute it happened for me, none of that shit happened. It was the craziest thing. And I'll never forget, I had hired this publicist, this big shot kind of Hollywood publicist. And at the end of the run of Sullivan and Son, she said to me, and I'll never forget it, she, and I paid this woman a lot of fucking money, and she goes, I'm shocked at the lack of interest in you. And it always just stuck with me, and I was like, fuck this, now I'm gonna blow it out. And so I've basically, 23 years in, I've never worked harder in my career as a stand-up comic, not only on my stand-up, but on the feature film, and then doing a documentary I directed on The Amazing Jonathan. And, you know, during this quarantine, I'm like, I'm not going to sit around and watch a bunch of movies like I see all these other comics tweeting about. I'm going to learn to do even more. And so I finished a television script, a feature script, and just trying to plow through and give myself the best opportunities I can while I have the opportunities.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that I have a really good buddy that's a musician, and I think he's amazing. And, you know, there's big time musicians that have heard him and they're like, man, you're amazing. And, you know, it's just some people just don't get those lucky breaks. And there's other people that I've listened to in comedy that I'm like, I hate to say it, Ed, like I always say, like with baseball or whoever, the best of the best are there for a reason, because somebody somewhere loves them, right? They're good. You know, it's different, like you said, in stats and baseball are different than, you know, comedy and music is more subjective, right, to the audience, and there's no numbers that can back it up. So it is very interesting, and I've learned that with comedy and music. And for me, like, I'll go watch somebody, and that night at the Comedy Store, I mean, that was my first time at the Comedy Store, which was awesome. I went with Mike O'Malley. Mike O'Malley? Yeah, so Mike O'Malley was with me. And and the cast of characters that came on the stage, because we went to go see Josh Wolf, a mutual friend, and and all of a sudden I heard the screaming in the back, and I was like, oh, man, somebody must be funny in there. And then we come to find out it was Seinfeld was performing.
Yeah.
So, and I'm so loyal that I was like, I'm not leaving this chair, because Josh, well, you know, Josh is my good buddy. I'm not leaving this chair, but I really want to go see Jerry Seinfeld do stand up. So I get mad at myself for my loyalty, but it was cool. And then, you know, Ali Wong was there, and who else was there? that night that I couldn't believe. I mean, Santino, you know, was there too, so we went to see him, and it's just such a cool place and such a cool environment. And I never, you know, I've heard about it, and I'm just going there for that first time. But the one thing I got from yours was your interaction with the audience is great. You know, can you explain, like, because some comics, or, you know, they interact with the crowd more and some don't. And why is that a part of your act?
Yeah, the crowd interaction, like, we call crowd work. When you do crowd work, like, when I was a New York comic, right? So I was past all the clubs, moved to 22 or 23, I moved to New York City. And basically there's an echelon of comedy clubs in New York City, and the Comedy Cellar is kind of like the club. That's the spot. That's the one every comic wants to perform at. That's the one that, you know, Chappelle will go to, and anybody who's doing like Colbert and Tuning Up, they'll go to the Cellar at night. So I was so young and naive and confident and blind optimism. That was the first club I passed at, and I didn't even know the deep history or anything to deal with it. And so I passed there, and this is kind of like a funny story of like my initiation there. And I'm sure that you've had processes where you've gone through this, but you pass at the Cellar, you're the new kid on the block, and I'll never forget this. I think it was the third day I was there. My spot was like at midnight. So this is back in the late 90s when nobody's really, comedy's not what it is today, right?
Right.
So I'm downstairs performing in front of a dozen people. And then I'm 2 minutes into my set, and then in walks Patrice O'Neill, Jim Norton, Greg Giraldo, Colin Quinn, Rich Voss, and Keith Robinson.
Wow.
Like
star-studded.
The Knights of the Round Table of the Cellar, right?
Yeah.
And they come in, and they sit in the empty front row while I'm doing my set. And I know who they are, and I'm just scared shitless now, right?
Especially with Patrice,
so they
right?
They sit down, and they look at each other, and they nod their head, and then they watch me. And it gets to me, and I start fucking bombing. I'm bombing so hard, I can't even describe it. And so I'm about to do my closing bit, and then Patrice looks at them all. They all nod their head, and they stand up, and they walk out during my closing bit, which is the worst time for anybody to do anything when you're a comic. So I'm closing up my show. They distract everybody by getting up and walking up. And I fucking bombed so hard. I've never bombed as hard in my life as that moment, because it was psychological. They did it to me. I crumbled under the pressure. And then I got off stage and I was like, fuck, oh my God, I don't deserve to be here. That was horrible. And I walk up to the Comedy Cellar table and they all start slow clapping me. And I'm like, you motherfucker. And they completely got me. And I was like, okay, welcome to the club. So that's kind of like the high wire tension of the Cellars, that you're with all these great comics and you had to perform, you had to execute, much like the store. And so I was doing 7 or 8 shows a night in New York City on a Monday, on a Tuesday, on a holiday. It didn't matter. I was so young and hungry. And I thought to myself, at least one show, I'll just do crowd work and I'll focus on just improvising with the audience. And so that's what I did every night in New York. And so I kind of became better at it than most. I wouldn't say I'm the best by any means, but I'm pretty darn good at it. And when I'm on the road, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I'm doing 6 or 7 hours of my material so that when I go to this comedy store, I will just do crowd work at the store. That's all I do because I'm so sick of my act.
Nice.
And I can't do my jokes anymore, and I don't want to punish those people anymore. So I just do crowd work, and I fucking love it because you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to happen. You think that's a father and son. It could be a gay couple. It could be, you know, 1,000 different variables. And then I love the adrenaline rush of seeing, okay, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to craft with this? And you just hope to God you're on your toes.
Yeah. And that night you were there was like 4 guys. I'll never forget this. And like every comedian kept asking, hey, are you 4 buddies together? And they all look at each other. And one guy, I guess, I don't know, you guys said the look. Every comedian talked about this one guy that was in the front row that looked like he was falling asleep or dead or on, like, and you kept asking, are you all right?
Yeah, there is.
Are you all right?
There's just some people that just, as a comic, people go, why do they keep talking to that guy? Well, that guy looks like fresh meat. That's what it is. I mean, there's a plethora of things you could shit on that person for. And I think comics just smell it, and probably it just becomes redundant for the audience. But for comics, though, it's like, I just got to the party. You can't shit on me because how can I not make fun of this guy?
Right. Well, that night it was. I mean, these guys were just bait. I mean, they were all four sitting together. They're all separate individuals. And so it was all so confusing for you guys, which I thought was hilarious. And I swear it was like four different comedians came up and said the same thing. Josh did and other people. And then you realize, you're like, wow, like, you know, and as a person in the crowd, you're just laughing at it. Like, wow, yeah, it is kind of odd that they just put four individuals in the front row together and they didn't come together. Hey, friends, I want to tell you about Loma Brewing Company, based in beautiful downtown Los Gatos, California. A brew pub that specializes in hoppy ales and crisp lagers that are paired with California comfort food. Come grab a fresh pint or take home a four-pack of our Appeasement IPA, Jiu-Jitsu Hazy IPA, and Loma Vida Mexican-style lager. Loma Brewing Company in Los Gatos, California. Visit lomabrew.com.
I want to ask you this, Kev. Like, what, because you're a professional athlete, I'm a comic, and I'm sure you've talked to so many people in our situations, you travel more than, I think, hockey, basketball, baseball, football is easy, right? But
yeah.
But with you, you're traveling so much over the course, you probably travel more than most touring comics. What is your favorite city to go to and worst city to go to?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a question I was going to ask you, too. You have to answer after me. For me, you know, the travel, you know, we traveled a ton. And when people say, do you miss, you know, playing baseball? I said, I miss walk-offs. I miss, like, the joy of winning a game with your teammates and that just that crazy moment that everyone is cheering for each other, celebrating together because it's time to go eat and it's time to go home. I really loved going. It's interesting. There's a couple cities that I always was like, yeah, Chicago was always one because growing up in the Midwest, you have a bunch of friends that are there. So I always loved going to Chicago, especially in the summertime. It was just gorgeous. So Chicago was always number one. Anaheim, I always loved the field. I thought it was just such a cool field, the rocks in center field. The playing surface was amazing and perfect weather, right? So those two were probably my favorites going on the road. Tampa Bay was hands down my least favorite place to go.
Right.
Just because it's in St. Petersburg, the stadium just is not, it's not a baseball park, and it's just not fun. And just, it's 90 degrees out, and we're staying in St. Petersburg, and there's nothing to do. So I would have to say the Tampa was definitely my least favorite, but Chicago and Anaheim. Chicago more for just the city and ambience of off the field, and Anaheim was the playing. So, yeah, what are your favorite cities to travel to and least favorite?
I love cities that have like a vibe about it, an electricity. And so New York, Vegas, and New Orleans are three of my favorites.
Ooh, cause good one.
There's just a, like, you're part of the city, part of the fun, you're part of the excitement, you're part of the entertainment. And I always loved that. I also love Phoenix because Phoenix, especially when I was young and single, like, there's just something about the girls out in Phoenix. They're just, I don't know, prettier.
I lived in Scottsdale when I was 25 to 30. So I know what you're talking about.
There's just something about it. One of the craziest experiences I ever had as a comic was in Phoenix. So I had done this thing, this tour called the Young Comedians Tour, where I was touring with Sebastian Maniscalco, Bert Kreischer, Brett Ernst, Mike Young, Butch Bradley, and the cast would rotate, but we'd all just travel together. It was like four or five guys. We'd do our show. We'd get hammered. We'd end up in fist fights. And we'd try to hook it up with girls. It was the best. And I remember this one time I was in Phoenix. Me and one of the comics, we hooked up with these girls. And at the end of the night, I ended up back in this comic's room. And we were all there. And the girls are going to take off. And I was like, hey, I'll walk them to their car. He's like, you're going to walk them to the car? I was like, yeah, I'll walk them to the car. He's like, okay. So I catch up to the girls, and they're in an elevator to go to the parking garage. And this one guy, African-American guy, was holding the door open. And now there's four guys behind him, and they're all African-American. So the reason I say that is because it's prevalent to the story. So I snoop under his arm as he's holding it, and he's trying to hit on the girls. And I'm like, I'm trying to be peacemaker. I'm like, guys, I get it. You know, we're just going to walk the girls to the car. And this guy, I don't exist. I'm Patrick Swayze and Ghost. I'm not even there. And he's like, come on, girl, give me a number. She's like, I'm not giving my number. He's like, come on, don't you want to hang? She's like, I don't want to hang. And I'm like, all right, let's call it a night here, guys. I don't exist again. His buddy's tapping him on the shoulder going, let's go, let's go. He holds up his necklace. He's like, you want to hang with this bling? You can't handle this bling. She's like, I don't want your bling. Just leave me alone. The guy goes, come on, girl, give me your number. She's like, I'm not giving you my number. And then she drops the N-bomb. And I'm like, oh shit.
No.
She calls him the N-word. He comes in the elevator towards her. I step in front of him. And, you know, all my life I've played ice hockey. And any fights I've gotten into, you grab the jersey, right?
Right.
And you pull it over the guy's head. So I get in between them, and I grab his shirt. He grabs mine, and now we're tussling. And instantly, I just reflexively pull the shirt over his head, and I start going to town because we're in an elevator. And the elevator's rocking back and forth, and I finally get the shirt over him, and I'm just wailing on his head. I'm like, you done? You done? He's like, chill, dog, chill. I go, you done? You done? He goes, chill, dog, chill. I go, are you done? He goes, I'm done. So finally, we separate. And what I didn't realize at the time is that when I was fighting him, we knocked the moorings off the elevator. So the elevator's stuck. So I'll never forget, the elevator's not moving. And Sarah Smiles by Hall & Oates is playing in the intercom overhead. And so we're all sitting there. The girl is crying. Her friend is consoling her. I'm standing there. This black guy pulls his shirt over his head, and he's staring at me. Staring at me. We're not moving. I'm hitting lobby like there's no tomorrow, right?
Oh, my God.
And I keep seeing this guy staring at me like, this guy's going to jump me again.
Yeah.
He wants round two. And I'm a little gassed. I'm not going to lie. So I'm standing there, and now we're just looking at each other, and I'm waiting for him to do something. And then he goes, then he says this, and I'll forget this. He goes, were you on BT's Comet View? I was like, yes, I'm saved. I go, yeah, I was. He goes, did you do that Bruce Lee sex bit? I go, yeah. He's like, man, I fucking love that bit. I was like, yeah. He's like, why are you here? I'm like, oh, I'm at the Improv down the street. That's why I met these racists. But if you want, I'll get you tickets to the show. He's like, I'd love to come see your show. So all of a sudden we hear, barrel, like perfect timing. The elevator doors open. His buddies rush in and start wailing on me because they heard us fighting. And he goes, no, chill, chill. You guys know who this guy is? He does the Bruce Lee bit on Comet View. They go, oh, shit, really? And then they all start, like, talking about Comet View. And then the lobby guy, the hotel guy goes, hey, I just called the cops. And everybody splits. Everybody
oh,
left.
Oh, my God.
And now I'm in the lobby. My shirt's ripped. One of the guys popped me in the eye. The other guy popped me in the lip, and my lip's bleeding.
Oh.
And the comic that I just left 20 minutes ago comes out of the business center, and he goes, what the fuck happened to you?
It's a long story,
so this
man.
It's like one of my great stories of
one
of my favorite cities to go to, Phoenix, which is always fun.
Yeah, you just got
to
watch out for the racist girls. You know,
they'll
always get you in trouble if you hang out with them. So you gotta get rid of the racist girls. Yeah, I'll tell you that I love, you know, I never had spring training in Arizona until I stopped playing and I started working with the Cubs, and it's I lived out there in North Scottsdale and went to that the golf. I think it's the Waste Management now, and yeah, it's a fun town, but man, it's a wild town. It's like Hollywood of the desert. You know, there's a lot of partying, a lot of, like you said, girls, a lot of plastic surgery. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll never forget, we were out there, I think in August, and this guy comes to us after the show. He's like, hey, do you guys want to golf? Do you guys like golf? We're like, yeah, we love to golf. He's like, I work at the Phoenician, which is like one of the best courses in Phoenix. Why don't you guys come tomorrow at like noon? We're like, fuck yeah, we'll come tomorrow at noon. We show up, nobody's on the golf course. We go to the first tee, and we realize it's 110 degrees. No wonder this guy gave us free tickets.
Yeah, right.
Fucking idiots we are. Nobody was golfing. But how about New York City? Did you like New York? I mean, did you guys, like, when you got went out, I'm sure that you got a lot of guff and stuff, but it must have still been fun. Is that correct, or am I completely off base there?
No, New York was fun. A lot of it was family trips a lot of times, so a lot of the families were there. But, yeah, I loved New York. I had good buddies there, and my uncle lived there, so I'd go down and have lunch with him at his restaurant in Tribeca, and, you know, a lot of, like I said, a lot of friends that live there too. So we go out at night and have a good time. You know, for me, it was, you know, there's a couple, stories. So it was funny. A couple of the NYPD guys that would be outside. I remember I went outside, I was going to go get a cab, and these NYPD guys look up at me and they're like, "Hey, Uke, what's up?" And I'm like, "Oh God, hey, how's it going?" I'm like, "Oh shit." And they're like, "Hey, where are you going?" I'm like, "I got to go down to, you know, wherever." And then he's like, "Hey, you need a ride?" I'm like, "Yeah." And I was like,
"That's pretty sweet."
Yeah, so these guys like got me in the car and took me down to meet some of my friends. But man, the whole ride, I'm like, they were cool and we were talking, but I was like, "Oh my God, this is like gonna turn up with like I'm gonna turn up like in the river or something, or like these guys are gonna play a joke on me and be like, yeah, screw you, you know, you get the hell out of here." So
well, I'll tell you, I think New York and Chicago are the last two cities where you would see anything like that happen. Because
right
in New York, they're not as, I think, like, by the book, you know what I mean?
Boston, and, too.
Boston, yeah. Like, when I lived in Chicago for 2 years, so, you know, not to name drop, but good friends with Vince Vaughn, who did Sullivan and Son together, and the feature film that's coming out, we worked on that together. So we would hang out all the time in Chicago, and I go to this bar called Tavern on Rush, which we used to go to all the time. Which
I know that one very well.
Viagra Triangle, right?
I know that one very well. That's Eddie's place, too, to name drop.
That's right, yeah. So we'd always end up at Tavern on Rush. No matter what the night was, we'd have a blast. And it was the first time I go there. His two friends, I don't want to say their names, I don't want to get them in trouble, but he goes, "Hey, why don't you give Steve a ride?" And they go, "Oh, you want us to give him a death ride?" I'm like, what's that mean? He goes, "Just get in the car. They want to show you something." So I get in the car, and I'm like, "Death ride doesn't sound fun, guys." And they're like, "No, just trust us." I get in, and they fucking turn the lights on and zip. I mean, we're going the wrong way down one-way streets. We're on the highway. And in the back, there's no seatbelt. It's a plastic seat case people throw up.
I'm getting tossed
back and forth. It was fucking the most scared. I've been on roller coasters. I've ended up in, like, you know, sticky shit. That's the most scared I've ever been in my life, was that death ride.
Do you slide on those, like, back? Those back seats are like the slipperiest things you've ever been on, too. It's like a water park.
Yeah, exactly.
You just get hit into the side. I mean, I got into that car that one time. I slid across all the way to the right. I was like, whoa. I was like, I've never been in the back like this.
Have you ever done whirly ball in Chicago?
No. Is that on the
beach?
You got
to do this next time you go. So Vince introduced me to this, and I'll never forget. I had gotten married, and then the next day I had the day off, and then my wife and I were going to our honeymoon, okay? So this day before I go to the honeymoon, Vince calls me up. He's like, "Hey, we're doing whirly ball." I go, "Great." So it's me, Vince, a few of our friends, some of the Blackhawks, and we end up at this place called Whirly Ball. And what it is it's a basketball court with a metallic floor, bumper cars on the metallic floor, and then like lacrosse sticks that you hold in one hand. It used to be called track ball. So, and then the basketball hoops are vertical. They're not, the hoop is not horizontal. It's embedded in the center of the hoop. It's a netting, but it's vertical. So basically, you got to toss the ball into this net, and a buzzer goes off. So we go play this whirly ball, and the crazy thing is they have a bar there. So you're getting hammered in between each game. Oh. You're in bumper cars with nine other guys. It's five a side. And I mean, guys are throwing rackets at each other, hitting the racket out of your hand while you're holding the ball. It's getting violent, and we're all getting banged up. And the thing about Vince Vaughn is he's very competitive.
Love it.
So we show up at 11. The place closes at 2, and he'll want to go. We did a best of 7. My team won. And I'm thinking, okay, night's over. No, we got to do another best of 7. We do another best of 7. My team won. Then it's like 4
he's
in the
pissed.
Morning. It's like best out of 3. I'm like, dude, my flight's at 6. He's like, best out of 3. Let's go. We do a best out of 3. I show up at my home at 4:45, I think. My wife was furious with me. She She's like, are you fucking kidding me? You've been up all night playing whirly ball. But I almost missed my honeymoon because of whirly ball. But it's one of the most fun things because people show up, they go, what the fuck is this? I've never seen anything like this.
Where is it at?
Pictures of beer. They have two or three of them in Chicago.
I got to check this out.
One of them right off of like 9094 as you're driving up to O'Hare, right off the highway.
Okay.
You'll see it. It's so fun. You got to do it.
Yeah, my general manager here, he's from Naperville, and we play college baseball together. He's from Chicago, so I'll ask him about it, and we'll have to take a trip up there, and he'll have to show me whirly ball. I've never even heard of it until now. We played Side Out on the beach, if you ever played Side Out. You ever done that before?
I've heard of it. I've never played it, though.
Yeah, so being in L.A., I think it's a San Diego game, but it's basically it's a triangle, and it's this big ball, and you hit it, and it's pretty fun. So that's another fun game to play. If you get Vince on the beach and get competitive,
yeah.
We played it in Chicago with all the front office guys, and it was that was a crazy game. I mean, it's a
what
lot
is
of
it
fun.
Like, I mean, you get to be exposed to two of the most classic ballparks in our country. I'm so glad that they've not been tampered with too much. I mean, Fenway yeah. is historic, obviously, and Wrigley is. I got to throw out the opening pitch at Wrigley a few years ago,
oh, cool.
and when I was practicing, I just took some grass and I ate it because I'm like, this is history. It's like I'm at Wrigley. This is unbelievable, and I got to do that. But I think that those two ballparks in particular is a comic. Whenever I travel, I try to go to as many ballparks as I can and see as much baseball as I can, and I think there's just something magical about those parks.
Oh, totally. I think the history within them and the stories that are told that are passed on from generation to generation, and it's super exciting as a player because when you're growing up, of course, I mean, when we were growing up in the Midwest, we got to watch, you know, the Cubs on WGN. I mean, that was, you know, I was a Reds fan growing up. You're probably a Pirates fan. So WGN and TBS were like pretty much the only stations that aired baseball games rather than like your local team and whatever, you know, whatever special day that they got to be on TV. So I would rush home from elementary school and be like, oh my God, you know, the Cubs are on. So I watched a lot of Cubs games, and now I get to work with, you know, Ryan Sandberg and Andre Dawson and Rick Sutcliffe. And
wow,
it's fun to, yeah, the Hawk. Oh my God. I share a locker like four away from him now. And he just, you know, he doesn't talk a lot, but when he does, I just sit and I just listen. I'm like, oh my God. Andre Dawson, and he still looks phenomenal. And he's, you know, he's got bad knees and all that, but he still walks around fine. He looks like he can kill you just by grabbing you. But he's the nicest human being. And yeah, so like growing up and seeing Wrigley and then playing on Wrigley, that was one of the cool parts. I didn't get too many games at Wrigley with Interleague, but you know, the funny thing about Fenway and Wrigley was the fields were crowned. You know, they had it crowned, and they were one of the last teams to get the crown out. So I was there in Boston when they took the crown out, like, so and they kind of flatten out the infield. So it's right. kind of funny when you're running to first base, you feel like you're running uphill.
Wow.
Taking the turn to go to second. It's, you know, it's uphill almost. So it's great when you're coming home. So when you're hitting third base and you're going, you feel like you're going downhill a little bit, but when you're trying to go to second base, it's, you know, it's a little bit of a crown. And so that was, and the infields were terrible. I mean, with the crown and the shape, and, you know, it's all for the drainage back in the day. But then finally some engineer figured out how to get the water out easier with a flat field. Thank God, whoever figured that out. But made our lives a lot easier as infielders and not getting balls off our eyeballs and our teeth. So, yeah, and then Fenway was just amazing, just the stories of the monster and Ted Williams and the fences and the bullpens and just all the history within it is really, really special. And I think that's the one thing that I've gotten out of working for the Cubs. And you know, Theo Epstein brought me over to help out, and it's cool. I mean, I love the story, you know, for me, because I'm a player. Like, as a fan, it's so different, right? So when you play for so long at that level, you forget what it is like to be a fan again. And that's probably one of the weirdest moments for me is when I went from playing to not playing anymore and having to sit in the seats. And it's such a weird, weird vibe the first time you sit in those seats. And
yeah, how long did it take you to feel comfortable enough to watch it without it maybe hurting or wanting to get up and throw your equipment on? Like, how long was that transition point?
I still want to get up to bat. There's some, because, you know, it's funny. It's like you sit there and you're, I mean, I sweat like crazy anyways, but I'm like, my armpits are sweating. Like, I'm like dripping, like nervous because I cannot control any part of this game, right? So I think that's the hardest part when I watch, you know, the Cubs or it's like the playoffs. And I'm just so, you just feel like helpless. Like, you're like, I used to be able to get up there and make that play or get that hit or, you know, score that run, but now I have to sit here and just wait for it and anticipate it and hope these guys, you know, can see what this pitcher's throwing. And I'm like, man, and you know, you sit back and it's easier. The hard part is when you retire is you watch the game and some guys forget how hard it is. So when you're watching the game, you always have to remind yourself, you know, you watch, you're like, oh, what are they, you know, because you hear fans around you, oh, what is he swinging at? And you can easily get into that. But what you have to realize is, think back to when you were playing and how you swung and missed at that pitch or how you made that error or how you did that. And I think that helps me when I watch games more now than ever is, you know, having the empathy. But yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's not easy. I mean, once you retire, for me, it was easy because my body was just killing me. And still to this day, I've had two herniated discs and plantar fasciitis in both feet. And so it took a toll on me. So it's a lot easier to say, okay, I'm good. You know, I don't need to go out there and just, you know, bust up another, you know, disc in my back. But for some guys, you know, that come out, I mean, no one leaves healthy, but I bet for, you know, and it is, it's a hard thing. And it's probably a hard thing for, you know, comedians too. It's like, once you get to a certain point and then you start seeing it not be the same, you know, a lot, I mean, you probably have a lot of friends that get into this, you know, in sports and baseball, you know, drugs or alcohol or, you know, adultery or things, you know, vices that happen. And for me, I've just been lucky. I got a great wife and great kids. And, you know, for me, I love that path. So I'm sticking to that path as best I can. And it's great.
Yeah, I think it's funny because I feel the same way you do. I have an incredibly patient, wonderful, secure wife. She's very secure with herself and, you know, there have been countless nights where I've been out on the road and, you know, I don't even end up calling her because after the show I get caught up with somebody that came to a show that I haven't seen since college. And, you know, you get caught up and it's 4 a.m. and you don't talk to her and never gave me guff, never gives me anything. And I think I've always been one of the comics too where, you know, I've had many conversations with people in radio or whatever and they go, you seem like a normal person. I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty normal. They're like, you're not like most comics. I'm like, no, my folks hugged me and told me they loved me and supported me. And, you know, they were just good folks. So I think I've always had a healthy head on my shoulders. But I think after doing this for 23 years, I was talking to a friend of mine, Dave Kooning, who plays for the Killers. He's the guitarist for the Killers.
Oh,
and
nice.
Talking about, you know, being like a professional entertainer, I love the show. I love the hour I'm on stage. What I cannot stand after 23 years of doing this is packing my bag, going to the airport, flying somewhere, having a layover, delayed flights, hoping to ride there to the hotel, checking in. They don't have the room. Like, all that shit can go. The hour on stage is what makes it somewhat worth it these days, you know? But there have been times where I'm on the road lately where it's just like, man, I don't know how much longer I can do the road because the road is just such a grind. It's brutal, but again, it's that hour you're on stage and you were at, you know, you were on the airplane and you grab the cocktail napkin and you write down an idea and then you execute it Thursday night. And then by Saturday night, you have a full blown bit that like that 3 minute bit just made your weekend. It's like, oh man, I got this great bit. Now I can't wait to take it to the store and see, you know, show it off to all my friends and stuff. So,
right.
So it's really like, it always comes down to the job. It comes down to the occupation. It comes down to the love and passion of why you started in the first place of like why, you know, there are so many times where even today where, you know, when I found out the film was being made or like we completed the last day of filming or we just mixed the film and it's completely done. And now we know when it's premiering. Like I remember those phone calls and every time I had those phone calls, I remember the day where I used to drive a Saturn and I had this Saturn and I put 150,000 miles on the Saturn in 2 years because I was traveling all over the country. I would do any shit gig. I was doing colleges. And I remember I was off the side of the highway, and it was like 2 a.m, and I didn't have any money. I had nothing until my next gig, and I had 2 days to go until my next gig where I got $50. And I put the seat back, and I was looking out through the back like window up at the stars, and I was like, it's gonna get better than this. You know, it's gonna get better. One day things will happen for you. But even right now, this is pretty fucking sweet because you're a comedian. You're not, you know, digging ditches in a cubicle. So even at that time when things were bad, it was still the romanticism of something's going to be better. And so anytime something has come along that's been better, I think back to that day and that Saturn. I'm like, see, it was worth it. You did it.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah, and like everything, I feel like, in the comedy world, it's the little things, it sounds like.
The little things in comedy. You know, even if it's just, you know, the one person dying in the corner, that it's like, maybe there's hope for this bit, you know, but if like 200 other people are not laughing, it's like, maybe not, but you're still hinging on that one. It's like, they know, they got it, so I'm gonna try this again tomorrow. And of course, you're probably wrong.
Yeah, and you say like the, you know, the grind, and a lot of people don't, you know, you said, to, you know, people don't understand the grind. You know, I think that's one thing that, you know, yeah, hear it with comedians, you hear it with athletes, especially baseball, it's the grind, 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 grind. And, you know, take us through like what the grind is like on a, you know, a weekend or a trip like that. You say that is, you know, from the moment you wake up and doing radio shows or whatever to the time you have to go with the fans afterwards.
The grind is, it's pretty taxing, only in the regard of like, you know, I love sleep. Like if I don't get 8 to 10 hours, like I just don't operate well. Some people can operate on 2 hours of sleep, but I need sleep. So here's what I'll do. I always book the first flight out. Always get the first flight out, because if you don't make the first flight, you got 4 or 5 other flights to make it to your destination that day, because cancellations and delays will happen. So I always take the 6 a.m. out of LAX. I get to the spot. I take a nap because I sleep on the plane. I'm like Mr. T. I'm always out on the plane.
Oh, man,
and then I take a nap when I get in. I'll do a little workout. I'll go over my notes. I'll get a meal maybe 2 or 3 hours before the show, because I can't eat before the show because then I'll feel lethargic when I do the show. Then I'll do my show. I'll come back. I'll eat like an eighth grader. I'll get pizza, onion rings, french fries, bullshit, disgusting. I'm 45. I shouldn't eat like an eighth grader, but I still do. And then I'll probably go to the gym and work out for a little bit, or I'll watch some movie, and then I'll pass out. And then I'll wake up at 6 a.m, because on Fridays you have to do your press. So okay. I'll do 2 or 3 hours of press, do my radio, come back, take a nap, you know, do some writing, do my shows. And when I do my shows, I always, always, always show up at the last minute. So if it's in walking distance, if the show starts at 7:30, I know that I have 25 minutes, a half hour until I'm on. So I will literally know that I'm on stage at 8 o'clock, show starts at 7:30, people would be shocked to know this. If you're sitting there watching the show, I'm probably getting in the shower at 7:40.
Wow.
So at 7:40, I'm showering, and there are times when I'm even showering like, man, this is fucking crazy. Like, you should be there earlier. But I always pull it off to the last minute.
What's the reasoning?
I don't like thinking about shit. I just like to do it. So I will walk in, and my dream is to walk into the comedy club and hear the act before me go, okay, you guys ready for your headliner? Like, that's my dream scenario. So I'll literally walk in, do the show, and then I'll zip out. And if there's two shows, like a Friday or Saturday, I'll leave and I'll go to my hotel room, and then I'll come back, just because I don't like sitting around. I don't like just kind of hanging out. I like to just kind of listen to my music or write or watch something and do something. There have been times where I've been stuck in the comedy club and I've fallen asleep in between shows, and the owner's kicking me going, he's calling you on stage. I'm like, oh shit. And I run up on stage like wiping saliva from my mouth because I'm just so relaxed being
awesome
on stage. I don't get nervous. I don't get stage fright anymore. You could put me up in front of 10 people or 20,000. It's the most fun. And I feel so comfortable up there.
Does that sometimes rub some of the other comics the wrong way? If you're like in that green room and you're just not paying attention? I mean, I know some people like to sit around and talk and do all that.
There's definitely comics that love like to chat in between shows and stuff. If like I'm friends with somebody, yeah, of course. But I kind of just like to listen to my music, and I'm not getting in the zone or anything. I just like to, I guess I'm kind of more of a loner than most people, so I do enjoy being by myself. I do enjoy kind of, like, when I'm on the road constantly, too, I'm eating by myself. I'm going to movies by myself. I'm going to museums by myself. You know, if there's a comic that is, in every city, there's always two major clubs. And most of the time, you'll land in Cleveland, for example, and I'll see who's at the Improv. I'm at Hilarities, and we'll text each other, or we'll write each other on Instagram, and we'll meet up for lunch. But for the most part, you're kind of flying solo, and I think that's the thing I'm always jealous of, in some regard, with professional athletes and friends I've become friends with, of like that camaraderie, that team element. And I'm sure that there's times where you guys want to just be by yourself, because, you know, if you're not that veteran star player that's earned the right to be in his own room, like, guys are sharing rooms together, right?
Well, not the major leagues. The minor leagues, you definitely share a room. But once you get to the major leagues, you get all the luxuries and perks. But, no, I'm with you. I was the same way. I go to lunch by myself, you know, unless it was going to meet friends. I always said I spend over 7 hours to 8 hours a day with the same people. So I always needed to get, you know, and on the road, we'd probably hang out more, as, you know, guys would hang out. But at home, I never hung out with my teammates unless it was like some event that we had to be at, because I needed my space. You know, I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah, we'll talk for 8 hours or whatever. We'll be together and all that. But, you know, I was the same way. I was very independent. I always, you know, in the minor leagues, I would go eat, like, you know, it was like Applebee's or whatever. Sit at the bar. You know, no one knew who the hell you were. No one cared who the hell you were. You know, and so it was great. And then you get to the major leagues, it changes a little bit. Early on, no one knows who the hell you are. And then once you establish yourself, a lot more people recognize you. So, no, I was the same way with that. So that's pretty interesting you said that, because...
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny, because I wouldn't say it's like Clark Kent Superman, but when I'm just dressed normally, I'm not Rogan, right? I'm not Kreischer, or D'Elia or Sebastian, where these guys are famous. You know, Netflix has anointed certain comics, for example, and for some reason, not that loop. So, clawing my way again, I'm familiar. People constantly see me and go, I know you from somewhere. And I constantly, you know, every time I fly, every time I go somewhere, it's always, I know you. And you never, ever do that. What I've learned is that the minute you do that, you put yourself in a situation where it's gonna be awful. So the last time I did it, this guy's like, I know you from somewhere. I'm like, well, I had a TV show for 3 seasons called Sullivan and Sonny. He's like, no, that's not it. I'm like, I've had our specials on Comedy Central. He's like, no. I'm like, I've done the Tonight Show quite a few times. Like, definitely not. And then he goes, did you work at Best Buy? I'm like, fuck this. I'm never answering. I'm never doing it because you do all that, and then they don't even give a fuck. They don't even want to ask, like, what's it like to be a comic, because I don't like to talk on the planes. I just pull my hat down.
Oh, it's the worst.
Go about my day. But yeah, I do miss that camaraderie of, like, when I had Sullivan and Son, like, working with Roy Wood Jr. and Owen Benjamin and Ahmed Ahmed, like, we were together all the time, but we were also comics, but we would just, there was, like, that team element of, like, we're on a show, and it was so fun. We had so many great memories. I remember we filmed on the Warner Brothers lot, and so you're in this cavernous soundstage all day, and it's dark. Obviously, you're inside, so you just want to get out and see some sun. So in the summers, we got a football, and we would just go outside. We'd have a half-hour break or whatever, and we'd just throw this football. And I'll never forget, Owen Benjamin, he's 6'7". This guy could throw a football 70 yards. No joke. I mean, not the greatest athlete, but, like, just a big guy and athletic.
Yeah.
And I remember we would just run rounds and he'd throw this football. And this one day, he threw this football. I mean, he fucking beamed it. And around the corner comes Clint Eastwood. Eastwood is at the back of this thing. And he's coming down. And I'm not lying when I say the ball missed Clint Eastwood by maybe 2 feet, maybe a foot. And he was looking towards this guy talking to him. And the ball came by the back of his head. And I'm telling you, if this thing hit a 70-plus-year-old Clint Eastwood, Owen Benjamin would have killed Clint Eastwood.
Oh, my God.
Talk about how he almost killed, you know, Dirty Harry. It would fucking crazy, like crazy.
That would have made the story that much better, though. I mean, that would have been even the funniest thing to see what Clint Eastwood, the look on Clint Eastwood's face when he got hit with the ball in the back of the head.
And, oh, yeah, just the last minute. But I will say this, because we're talking about going out on your own and stuff. The minute I put my suit on and I go perform, because I always perform in a suit, people then go, oh, you're that comedian. And that's been like my saving grace at times when I go out and I do a show and I'm just like, I feel like just going out tonight. I feel like just getting a drink. And I try not to go out with folks after the show because they paid to see you. And to me, that always felt weird. So I'll just go to a bar and I'll bar hop by myself and there'll be somebody that like recognizes me and I'll end up just saying, hey, I'll just get us around. And some of the best nights of my life have been with complete strangers just going out.
That's
and
awesome.
And then someone recognized, and then you got a great story, and then you got somebody that'll come to the show the next night, which is kind of fun, too.
Right, yeah, and then you also made their night. You know, they're going to tell that story and say, you know, how a great guy you are. And then, I mean, it's networking in some ways, right? I mean, it's basically a fan, you know, you made a group of fans right there that have friends that are going to become fans.
Yeah, in some regard. I mean, I've always been gravitated to when I go out with, like, I guess like underdogs or losers, or like you see a group of guys that you know are not the homecoming king,
yeah,
and they're just good nerds. And, you know, for some reason, like guys like that, I'll definitely be like, guys, we're going to have the greatest night of your life. Because I just know that these guys have never done like what we've done, you know? So it's just like, put your babysitting money away. Uncle Stevie's got it. We're going to fucking rip it up tonight. And there have been so many nights where you go out with like a group of like Asian and Indian guys and they're like, what? We're doing another shot? It's like, yeah, we're doing another shot. And then you end up at a strip club and you find the ugly stripper and you just dump $200 on her and go dance for him all night. And he's like, will you get the woman away from me? It's like, no, I paid her $200. She's dancing for you. Like those nights I enjoy.
It's that you're living the super bad. You're making the super bad movie.
Exactly. Yeah, super bad for sure. I mean, there's this one. I remember this one Asian kid. He came to the Sullivan and Son. We did a Sullivan and Son comedy tour, and he came by himself. And he reminded me of my cousin. And he's kind of like this portly Asian kid. He's probably, you know, early 20s, and I think he was a senior in college at the time. And he came by himself. Like, this kid's in college. He's never had a time of his life. So me, Roy Owen, took him out, and we were at Foxwoods, and we gambled, and we partied, and we showed this kid the greatest time of his life. And then I said, listen, we're still filming the show. Here's my number. You call me, and if you can get yourself to Los Angeles, I'll put you in the show. Well, 2 weeks later, this kid flew his ass out to Los Angeles.
No way.
And he's a kid that just ended up at a comedy show by himself. And now he's on a soundstage on the Warner Brothers lot doing a scene with Ken Jeong from the Hangover movies. And it's so funny because I just watched the episode the other night. I hadn't seen these things in 6 or 7 years since we filmed them. And I see the kid and I'm like, holy shit, what must have been going through that kid's head?
Because
he was in a scene where we had all these Asian doctors that came to the bar because of Ken Jeong and wanted to party instead of like being the responsible Asian. And we were holding up these bottles and just pouring shots, and Ken would call them baby birds.
Oh,
and he would
God.
Just hold out the thing and give them all shots and stuff. And I was like, man, what a story that kid must have. So I don't know. It's like along the way trying to have fun and making sure that others have fun along the way, especially as a comedian, because your job ultimately is to,
totally,
you know, just make people happy.
Yeah, I mean, that's it comes with the nature of probably what you do every day is like making people laugh, and it doesn't matter who's laughing. I mean, of course, there's certain people, like you said, like early on with Patrice and them, you're trying to get them to laugh. Probably, you know, other comedians you want, you know, to laugh just as much as your audience, and it's pretty interesting that, you know, you gravitate towards that crowd more because you want to provide them with a great time, and I think that's awesome. I think that's special, man. It's also feel, you know, like people that have feel and understanding.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, especially when I was in college, I'll tell you, there were always, like, when you're in college, you always want to, look, you want to meet the hot girls, you want to hang out with the hot girls, you want to hook up with the hot girls, right?
Always.
But there was a group of guys like I was friends with in college. Like if we saw, and this has happened a few times on the road with me when I'm on the road, I'll be with like a good group of guys. We all meet up, whatever, or there are other comics on the show. And then you see a group of girls that you know are not the homecoming queens or whatever. But you're like, you know what? They just seem like a fun group of chicks. Let's just go out with them and have a great time. And there have been quite a few nights like that where you know you're not going to hook up with them. And, you know, maybe right. like one of the guys is like, fuck, I'm hungry. I gotta take what I can get. But it's like you just know that nothing's going to go down, but you end up having more fun with these girls than you would a group of hot girls because these girls are actually, like, super fun. You know what I mean?
Totally, yeah. I mean, yeah, you also don't, you know, with no, you know, if you have no intent or intentions, too, it's also the night gets, the stories get way more fun when that stuff happens, too. Because there's no letdown at the end, right?
Completely. It reminds me of the story Craig Gass told me. Craig Gass told me about Gene Simmons, and Craig Gass is a guy that does impressions on Howard Stern all the time. He does Gene Simmons, he does Al Pacino. Really, really funny guy. And because he makes fun of Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley so much, they actually invited him out on their Kiss cruise, and he became friends with them and friends with the crew. So the crew would tell Craig all these crazy stories about Gene Simmons. And so they told this one story about how Gene Simmons one time, they're like in Kansas City and it's Tuesday, and Gene Simmons ends up going home with Miss America. Miss America is hooking up with Gene Simmons. So Gene Simmons goes up and hooks up with her. And the next day, Wednesday, they're like in Tulsa or something, and Gene Simmons ends up with this obese, like disgusting, not attractive woman. Okay. And the crew is just like, what the fuck? And the one crew guy at soundcheck the next day goes up to Gene. He goes, Gene, Tuesday you're with Miss America, and on Wednesday you're with a very, how else can I say this, a very unattractive woman. What's going on? And he said, Rick, here's the thing. You know, you can't go to Morton's Steakhouse every night. Sometimes you got to go to McDonald's. Such a great way to put it.
Is it Bert like in a thing with Gene Simmons right now, like on social media? Isn't he pissed off at Bert, Gene Simmons or something? I read.
You know, Bert Kreischer, I wouldn't put it past me, but I'll tell you that some of the funnest nights I've ever had in my life as a touring comic, because Bert and I did this Jameson Whiskey tour together.
Oh.
So Jameson Whiskey is sponsoring a tour with comedians on it, and before the tour starts, 2 weeks before the tour starts, they sent us each a case of Jameson whiskey.
Oh.
Now, I hadn't even opened this case. And the first day I show up, Bert's like, anybody else finish their case? I'm like, finish it? Like, he finished the case. My wife, the first time she met Bert, we're on the Jameson tour. Bert's drinking all, like, he just drinks all day. He's just
unbelievable.
I've never seen anything like it, okay? So the show finishes. My wife comes. This is one of the first shows she ever comes to, okay? Now the show ends, and as usual, we're all kind of hanging out, drinking afterwards. And her little sister, who just turned 21, comes to the show. She's going to college in the town. That's why I flew her out there. Bert comes out of the green room, butt naked, with a cowboy hat on and cowboy boots, and just fucking naked. And my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and her little sister goes, oh my God. And my wife just goes, is this what touring's like for you? I was like, yeah, pretty much. And we had a great time that night. And Bert is just one of those, and I'll never forget this. We wake up the next day after a night of drinking, and we get in a limo is waiting for us to take us to the airport. Now it's 5 a.m, okay? Bert comes to the limo like 2 or 3 minutes late, and my wife and I are sitting in it waiting to go, and Bert rolls in with 2 tall boys.
Oh,
and I'm like, dude, have you been up this whole time? He's like, no, I just woke up. I'm like, it's 5 a.m. He's like, I know. So he pops open the beer. He starts chugging these beers as we're driving the airport. It's 5 a.m. We get to the airport, and my wife's just kind of like, what the fuck? And we get to the airport, he's like, I got to find a bar that's open. I'm like, Bert, it's 5 in the morning. He's like, yeah, I just don't do well with flying.
He's scared shitless of flying.
I don't think you do well with just, like, you'll always find an excuse, but he's one of those guys that will always have a beverage in hand, but you would never, ever, ever know that he's been drinking all day. I think there's just something, his tolerance is high or whatever, but I've never heard him slur. I've never heard him really have an issue with a patron. He's never been in a bar fight. He's just one of those guys that is just like, he's a great hang.
He's
so fucking fun to hang out with, but it's just odd. I've never seen anything like it in my life.
It's unreal. I mean, there's certain people out there that they don't change like their mood, their person. I mean, they just get, I mean, sometimes they even get more fun, but not like, in, like you said, like not in the way of slurring. I went to dinner with him and Josh one night in LA, and I was like, oh my God, this is, you know, getting to talk to him and sit with him and Josh together. It was a great time just hearing, you know, just story after story. And I'll tell you, it's kind of funny just how I've always wondered that too, because I played with guys that go out drinking one night and then they'll be on the treadmill running, and I'm like, holy cow, I would be in the fetal position. Like, there's no way I'm like even like getting near a treadmill. The only thing I'm getting near a treadmill is to put my head on the side of it because it's at the perfect height. But like,
well, dude. I gotta have you meet my buddy Dave Bolin, because Bolin, he played with the Hawks. He won 2 cups with them, and he just took a job with the Blackhawks in an office position.
Oh, nice.
So he'll be in Chicago full time come this upcoming season.
So he works with Chelios, yeah. So,
oh yeah,
yeah, Chelios back.
Vince and Bolin and I used to go out all the time in Chicago, and Bolin would, you know, I remember the first time I went out with him, just like a really, like, sedate, polite Canadian, you know, you talk to all these hockey players after a game, it's just like bland, right?
Yeah.
There's no personality in hockey. And then I meet him, and he's such a nice guy and sweet, and then he's like, hey, come meet me at this bar. And I go, okay. I walk in. As soon as I walk in, he sprays me with Dr. Pepper. He's behind the bar, his shirt's off, like, who the fuck is this guy? He's like Jekyll and Hyde. And some of the craziest nights I've had out have been with Dave Bolin, and thinking that, you know, the next day it's like, dude, you got a game, right? He's like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm going to be great. I'll never forget, they told him when they won the Stanley Cup, they said he's the only Chicago Blackhawk after the first cup that was living in Chicago. They go, the president, I think Rocky Wirtz is the president. The president of the Hawks called Dave personally and said, listen, I know you're going to be in town. Whatever you do, do not take the Stanley Cup to Wrigley Field. Do you understand? Dave's like, I absolutely understand. I will not take the cup to Wrigley Field. Flash forward, like, you know, all those hours later, he went to one of the rooftop deck parties.
Awesome.
And he's holding the Stanley Cup up, and now everybody in Wrigley's cheering, and they've had to get a police escort out of Wrigley Field. And he got an earful the next day, that's for sure.
Oh, for sure. That was one of my questions. Have you drank out of the Stanley Cup?
I never drank out of the Stanley Cup.
Oh.
I'll never forget the one time I was on the road in Chicago. Vince was at a restaurant we used to go to called Prosecco. And they have a basement downstairs, a really great Italian restaurant. And Vince was filming The Dilemma at the time, so Ron Howard came, and Coach Quinville came with the cup to visit Vince, and they all got to drink out of the cup that night. And I was so pissed. I was like, I was probably in, you know, Indianapolis, of course, you know, at the time, like, fuck. But I never got to drink out of the cup. Did you?
I did. I actually got to drink out of it with Sean Thornton when he was with the Bruins. So,
oh man, that's awesome.
Yeah, so I got to, you know, he's a good buddy of mine, and he's going to be on one of the podcasts too. We've shared a love for craft beer and IPA, so we always go out and have a good time together. And yeah, I got to do it in Boston at the Cask and Flagon right behind Fenway Park. So it was,
oh wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was super incredible, and definitely now I'm like, now my mission is to get you to drink out of the Stanley Cup. I just want to let you know that now, because that was one of my questions. Would you give up one of your testicles to drink out of the Stanley Cup? And which one?
Either. I'll be the Lance Armstrong of comedy. I'll do either. I don't care. I just want to give me a taste of it. Yeah, I got to tell you, your brewery is outside of San Jose. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's 15 minutes probably from the Improv.
Okay, because I know I'm there like Thanksgiving weekend. So,
oh, nice.
But But when this is all over, said and done, this quarantine,
yeah,
I would love to, like, I was talking to one of my buddies who's a huge Red Sox fan, and I told him I was doing this with you. He's like, are you kidding? I'm like, dude, when this quarantine's over, we should just get in the car, get a great hotel, and I'd love to just, like, my first beer would be at your spot when this is all lifted. Let's love to do that.
I got a hotel right for you here in Los Gatos, so we got a hookup there. We'll line it all up for you, and we'll have a big bash here. It would be awesome.
Done deal. I'm in. I think we should do a show there. I think we should talk to Wolf.
Yeah.
And get like another comic or two. I know that there's quite a few guys. And I was talking to Roy Wood Jr., who's on The Daily Show. And he's done the pitch for the Cubs, I think, twice now. But he said he'd love to talk to you as well on your podcast.
I laughed so hard at Roy Wood Jr.'s post the other day about how you look at the lineup card and you're not in the lineup card. Did you see that one?
No, I didn't see that one.
Oh, my God. It was so great. He has, like, Mike Trout playing two positions because he's that good. He's like, now look, if you're in the lineup card, you got to look at it, and you got to keep a straight face. No emotion. He's like, because if you're not in it, you got. He just starts going into game-facing the lineup card when you're not in the lineup card and you're a bench warmer. Oh, my God, I was dying. It was great.
I'll tell you something else, Kev. Roy is a guy that was so talented. I mean, he is so talented, but he's a guy that the industry absolutely ignored. For years, they ignored Roy.
Aye.
And he's another scratcher and clawer. License plate when he was just a road comic was No Sleep, because he would never sleep. He was just always grinding. And I had to fight to get him on Sullivan's Son cast. And that's kind of what turned the tide for Roy. And I'll never forget, our producers, I brought Roy in for the first audition, and they're like, no, he's awful. And I'm like, guys, I'm telling you, he's so funny. But because I was a producer, I called the casting director for the second round of auditions. I said, can you bring Roy Wood Jr. back in? She goes, are you sure? I go, yes. So I called Roy. I talked him through it. He came in. He did a little better, but the producer's like, no, absolutely not. Do not bring him in again. Third audition. I call the casting director. I go, bring Roy Wood Jr. And she goes, they said not to. I go, but I'm a producer too, so bring him in. Please bring him in. She goes, okay. Brought him in. I go, Roy, talk to an acting coach, whatever. I don't care. Just work on this, and here's what you need to know. And I gave him some inside baseball. Comes in, has a great audition, and it's at the end of the audition process, and Rob and Peter, the producers, go, are you sure? I go, I'm telling you, this guy's one of the funniest guys I know. And he can do this. He can really do this. They go, okay. You believe in him that much? Okay. So they cast him. Second episode, we give him a line on the fly. He knocks out of the park. And at the end of the season, they go, you were both right about Roy.
That's awesome.
The whole time Roy was on the show, for three seasons, he could not get Comedy Central to give him a half hour. A half hour. And they're like, no, not at all. Roy was just like, I feel like Morgan Freeman at Shawshank. I just don't know when this will end.
Right.
And then he got on The Daily Show, and then everybody started blowing him, you know? So
that's so good.
He's just like another testament of, like, hard work, hard ethic, you know, all that stuff. It'll go the distance for you. And he's just one of those great, great guys. And he's so funny on social media. He's one of the best at it.
Oh, he's good. Yeah. Those are my I think that's the bond and the, you know, camaraderie, like the blue collar, like we were talking about earlier. It's just, you know, there's a, no matter what field you're in, you know, that things weren't handed to you. You kind of have that group of people that can relate. It doesn't matter what line of work you're in too. And you, like you said, you flock together. So it's one of those interesting parts, but so let's wrap this up here and, tell everyone where they can find your stuff if they're listening.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much again for having me, Kev. I appreciate it. Everything I have is at Steve Byrne Live, like all the social media, and it's BYRNE. And my feature film called The Opening Act will be coming out this October, I believe. It was supposed to come out in July, but because of the coronavirus, I think we're going to kick it off in October. And it's a great film about a kid's very first time ever on the road as a professional comedian. And it's got a stacked lineup of stand-up comics. Jimmy O. Yang from Silicon Valley plays like a younger version of me. He's the MC. Alex Moffitt from SNL plays the feature act, and Cedric the Entertainer plays the headliner. And then it's got Whitney Cummings, Eliza Schlesinger, Angela Johnson, Kevin Milligan, Bill Burr, Ken Jeong, Tom Segura, Neil Brennan, Roy Wood Jr., Felipe Esparza, Alonzo Bowden, like so many great comics. It'll come out, and everybody's been to a comedy club, but nobody's ever been on the road, and this film is what it's like to be on the road as a comic for a typical weekend. So it's a fun one, and I can't wait for people to check it out.
Oh, that's great. And what will it come out on?
We're going to find out. We'll find out. And then I directed a documentary about a good friend of mine called The Amazing Jonathan. He's a great comic magician.
Yes.
That was one of the first comics to pop off of Comedy Central.
Very funny.
And that's on YouTube. It's completely for free. Type in Always Amazing. And my good friend Bill Burr released it on his YouTube channel. So that's out there now, too. It's a lot of fun if you like comic, if you like stand-up, if you like documentaries. But also the magic element, he's great at it. One of the best ever done it.
Yeah, and Bill Burr, I got to see him out here right down the street at the Mount Winery. He was killing it. So good old Boston guy.
Burr is one of the biggest Sox fans, obviously, and I know you've met him, right?
I have not. I think I met him one time, if I remember, like way long ago, but I haven't like got to sit down and talk with him, and I didn't get a chance to after the show he did here, but I definitely want to sit down and talk to him because I love his work.
Did I tell you what happened at Yankee Stadium with Burr?
No.
So I'll leave you with this. So Burr and I, we were in stand-up. He started a year or two before me, but we were kind of like, you know, young guys at the same time. So we would always go to sporting events together in New York to kill time. And we used to go to a lot of Yankee games. And he would just sit there and heckle the Yankees. He'd heckle everybody because he's such a Sox fan.
Because he's a Sox fan.
Of course. So this pop fly comes up, lands in the section we're in, and this adult gets in front of this kid and catches the ball. And so some people cheer, and the guy's turning around like, yeah, I did it, right? And this kid sits down. He's dejected. And the set starts chanting, give it to the kid. Give it to the kid. Give it to the kid. And the guilt finally gets to this guy, and we're yelling at the guy, too. And the guy stands up, and he holds the ball up and dramatically hands it over to the young boy. And the whole crowd starts clapping, and the boy smiles, and the guy high-fives the kid, and everybody's happy. Burr stands up. He's like, you fucking pussy. You should have kept the ball. Hey, smoke this. Everybody else is smoking it. And the whole crowd starts laughing. Burr goes into this guy for another 5 minutes, just tormenting this guy. I had some like standing up and giving Burr the finger. I've never seen a comic like treat a section at a baseball game like a comedy club. He eviscerated this guy. I was in tears. I was laughing so hard. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen at a sporting event. It was great.
That's awesome. That dude, he's so funny, man. And I could just picture this all happening and just seeing the look of, oh, man, it's hilarious.
One of the best.
Oh, man. Well, thank you, Steve, for doing this. Definitely we'll have to line you up to come up here to Loma Brewing Company. We'll have some fun times. I know a lot of people here will appreciate getting a comic to come up and give him some things to laugh at, and I guess we'll have to be within 6 feet. I don't know. We'll have to figure out all that.
Yeah, exactly.
But screw it.
Kev, I'll tell you though. Congrats on such a storied career, and thanks for being such a sweet guy and keeping in touch and having me on your podcast. It was great to chat with you. I thought this was going to be 20, 30 minutes. I had no idea we'd be on this long. So thank you so much, man, and thanks for being a comedy fan. I cannot wait to come up to your brewery and have a proper drink.
Oh, can't wait to have you up here, and I'll definitely be coming down to L.A. when I get a chance.
Absolutely, pal. All right, well, be well, best of the fam, and thanks again, and good luck on the podcast.
All right, Steve, thanks. Talk soon.
All right, pal. Bye.
All right, bye.
This has been the Greek God of Hops podcast with Kevin Youkilis, sponsored by Loma Brewing Company. Visit lomabrew.com. Produced and powered by Mudhouse Media. Music by Will Daly.